You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Academic discussion on net neutrality. The moderator was Rob Atkinson, Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Panelists included David Farber, School of Computer Science, Carnegie Mellon University, David P. Reed, MIT Media Laboratory, Timothy Wu, Columbia University Law School, Christopher Yu, Technology and Entertainment Law Program, Vanderbilt University. Due to technical problems, the first few minutes of this discussion were not recorded.
Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon holds a secondary appointment at the Hines School of Public Policy. He recently retired as the Alfred Fittler Moore Professor of Telecom Systems at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm not going to read Dave's extensive biography. It's long and distinguished, but I would just point out that he was also chief technologist at the FCC. I also was reading an email today I got, and I guess some article in Forbes, where I hadn't heard this before. Dave is the grandfather of the Internet. Did you know that? I don't know what that means, but it means that Dave knows an awful lot and is an expert.
Let me take a second to say it's because some of my students were among the real fathers of the Internet, so I consider them my academic grandchildren.
So Tim Wu to my two left here. Tim is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School. Basic research focuses on the intersection of international copyright and telecom law. And again, I won't read the long bio. After a stint at DOJ Office of Legal Counsel, he clerked for Chief Judge Richard Posner in the Seventh Court of Appeals and Justice Stephen Breyer in the Supreme Court. He's also, I think, unique in some sense because he actually has a background that has worked in the telecom industry, so he brings practical experience as well as extensive legal scholarly background. David Reed. David is an adjunct professor. Is that at MIT, David?
Yes.
Okay. That manage, communicate, and manipulate information shared among people. David, maybe David's the other grandfather. He's best known for co-developing the Internet design principle known as the end-to-end argument. He's also a member of HP Laboratories, where he's an HP fellow, and has extensive background in electrical engineering, computer science, BS, MA, EE, PhD. So extensive technology background. And finally, Christopher Yu. Christopher is a professor of law and the director of the Technology and Entertainment Law Program at Vanderbilt University. He's emerged as one of the nation's leading authorities on law and technology. Research focuses on technological innovation and economic theories of Imperfect Kennedy in the Supreme Court and Justice Raymond Randolph of the U.S. Court of Appeals. And before that was with Hogan and Hartson. So, let me just jump right in and get started. As you can tell, we've got a great panel, both sides, if you will, represented in the debate, as well as very strong legal as well as technological perspective. So I think that'll let us dig into this. Let me start with David Reed. David, one of the core arguments we hear about that keeps going back and forth in this debate is at the end of the day, it's an argument about whether the Internet today is neutral. And there are people who say it is neutral. There are people who say, well, the Internet is not neutral today, so why would we want to mandate any kind of regulation or law that would make it neutral? So do you think the Internet is neutral? If so, if not, what are the exceptions, and how does that apply to this debate?
Well, you know, actually, I think it's very weird to hear the question about whether the Internet is neutral. The Internet is incredibly competitive, and there's no, you know, neutrality in a competitive world. I think that's crucial. What seems to be the case as we look at how the Internet has grown with all the stakeholders involved is that architecturally it remains incredibly vibrant and competitive, and all the different players are trying to get advantages over each other, and so far no one's gotten a particularly strong advantage from any one point of leverage. So I think the threats to neutrality show up everywhere in the architecture, which was designed to be open and innovative, and they show up wherever there's a bottleneck in the architecture. The current threat is probably on local access lines, which, though the folks that try to sell you the internet service at your home would like to claim that they actually give you the internet, all they actually do is give you a driveway onto the internet, and yet they would like to use that as a lever to get some edge. And I think that's really one of the challenges, although there's lots of challenges elsewhere in the internet as well.
I mean, Dave, you want to take a crack at that issue? Because we hear this with, for example, Akamai is an example of a network that's not neutral, either caching, and there are other examples there. Do you think that inherently the network is neutral?
Yeah, I tend to agree with David on his comments. The net is a very competitive world, and Akamai saw a point where they could compete and add service to the users of the network. I think I'd call them reasonably neutral, because in fact, if you can come up with a better scheme than Akamai has, you can be highly competitive and put them out of business.
Well, that is a nice segue into the next point, and maybe Tim, you can address this. You hear this debate again with net neutrality that people make, this distinction between competitive markets and parts of the network that are less competitive. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that distinction? Do you think that is really the crux of this concern, is that there's less competition in the last mile? And if there were more competition, you hear this, for example, in the UK, where they have multiple ISPs, and so net neutrality is not a concern. Some people say, do you agree
right.
with that?
I think there's two views here. I think one. I think certainly the proximate cause of a lot of the concern is the state of duopoly, which is the fact for most Americans in the last mile. And so I think were there, and I think David was right. I think were there an incredibly competitive last mile, like in the days of dial-up ISPs or regulations to make the last mile carry non-discriminatory, you'd have a lot less problem. Nonetheless, there's also a view that even competition would not necessarily. There's a view, and I'm going to put it out there without saying I endorse it, that there's a value to having a meritocratic, fairly neutral end-to-end network which transcends issues of competition. That is, there's a view that competition won't necessarily solve all the problems in this area, and there's some value in having a public infrastructure, like the roads or whatever, which is anti-discriminatory, because of the benefits it has for the nation's economy, and that competition might not reach that level. So there's sort of two views here. One view is that competition will solve all problems. Another view is you just need to have certain infrastructures in this country which have a degree of neutrality or a degree of non-discriminatory carriage, because that is a booster to the economy. In the same way we think that trains are a booster to the economy when they have to carry everyone, and the same way we think that roads, with non-discriminatory carriage, are a booster to the economy. So there's two views there.
Christopher, you want to take a crack at that? You've written that competition is an important part of this, and how do we get a regulatory regime that spurs that?
We do need a regulatory regime that spurs competition. And the way the conventional policy analysis is that you look at the part of the market that is the least competitive and try to make that the more competitive. And so, in other words, if you look at this industry right now, competitive, has the most players and the least protected by barriers to entry. Content and applications is the most competitive part of this business. It's extremely vibrantly so, and there's virtually no barriers to people getting in. The real problem is we have no competition. We have some competition backbones. The real lack of competition is the last mile. And the real issue is if I think we can accomplish nothing else about the most important thing we can accomplish today is most of the network neutrality debate has been focusing on its impact on content and applications, which from a policy point of view should be the part of the market we're worried the least about structurally. The real driver of this conversation is the rules we adopt, whatever they would be and wherever you advocate. What I'm hearing is some consensus is that the real key is whether it'll give us more options in the place where we have the fewest options, which is the last mile. Now, the question about whether the internet is neutral, it's an interesting problem. I guess right now we have a tradition of a very hierarchical internet. You have an ISP that has a connection with a backbone, and then that backbone gives it to the terminating ISP, and that goes to a client. And that was the traditional idea, sort of one-to-one response with these handful of backbones really at the core and moving out. What we're seeing now is a really diverse world where some people are, ISPs are entering into secondary peering relationships and bypassing the backbone altogether. Akamai is distributing caching, bypassing the backbone altogether. And it's becoming much more heterogeneous, largely in response to the fact that what we're demanding from the network is much more heterogeneous. And the interesting question to me is, even in this world, should we have one architecture? And if we have three players that are trying to experiment, we may see them want to respond into what I call, in my work, network diversity. Not that the whole internet's going to look like this, or the whole internet's going to look like that. What you may see is competition between different visions and different players of different ways to design a network, and that can be a new dimension of competition. To give you a concrete example, cell phones fought it out between TDMA and CDMA. They were non-interoperable at some level, but they were interoperable at another level. They were designed in a different way of routing, different way of using spectrum, and we had a competition. Had we locked in too early, we would have chosen TDMA, which is, it turns out, the worst one for transitioning to wireless broadband. So I think that, you know, what I would see is allowing people, giving people the internet room to experiment and to try different things, and not taking a monolithic idea of let's keep it the same this way or keep it the same that way.
Yeah, Tim, I want to come back to you because I want to let you, because you've written about this issue of is the last mile a natural monopoly, and is competition, you know, is five providers appropriate? And I don't know if that's what you were going to get at. But
yeah, well, I didn't want to necessarily get a natural monopoly, but I want to say that I don't fully agree with Chris Yu's economic analysis of the situation, and I don't think it's the conventional analysis always. There are such a, what you're neglecting in your statements are the values of standardization. And you know, we've seen in a lot of areas there are values to having standardized and open platforms, and in some cases keeping those standards or open is important for the growth of the economy. I look, you know, this is, we sort of repeat the same example sometimes, but if you look at the electric networks or if you look at the English language, they're examples of standards where it doesn't necessarily follow that it would be great or ideal to have 10 different English languages. Now, or you know, to have 20 different languages sponsored or competing. What I want to that's one point that may happen naturally. What I also want to suggest is we do live in a world of network diversity in the sense that we have the phone networks and the cable networks. And I think what a lot of this debate about is whether there should be some room given or whether we think it's important to have a network that stays open, given that we already have the right and the existence of several private networks. You know, there's no, I was talking with Verizon people yesterday, and there's nothing stopping anyone from building a purely private network at this point. If they want to build a purely private network devoted to streaming video, it's actually called the cable network. Right, or you can build a different kind of cable network if you want to build specific content privatized networks. What this debate has been over about is whether there's some value in having a public network, one which the government originally sponsored the research for, which remains open to all comers. And that's, I think, the central question.
Let me go to Dave and then David.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on standardization. The current internet is highly standardized. You use TCP/IP, the whole set of protocols. What happens in back of the curtain is the place where, in fact, diversity, if you want to look at it that way, different ways of providing those services are very easy to do now because you have that one interface as opposed to, say, the cell phone when it was hard to actually do things under some of those interfaces. I'm surprised that you actually think it's easy to do streaming video on a cable system. Has been my experience getting access to the cable channels, other than its little 6 megabit piece of it, is rather difficult in practice.
And what I meant is the entire cable system is designed for delivering video channels.
David, did you? And I guess this question I asked you, Dave, is this point? It seems to me what Dave's point is that TCP/IP is not under any threat, but that there are diversity underneath it. Do you agree with that? And
well, actually, I was going to get at that because I think the other side of the issue, which a fundamental principle of the internet, probably even deeper than the one I'm sort of associated with, the end-to-end principle, is the idea that everything is interconnected. That is, from any point in space, you can reach any one you want to communicate with. It's the ultimate in what you might call freedom of speech, except architecturally it's not focused on a policy goal. It's focused on the goal of saying you offer the choice to the end sender of a message or receiver of a message to reach any part of the globe. And that was, you know, Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn's insight. It came from Licklider, who was their 1968 wrote the visionary statement of what the internet was about. The game that's being played now, and it's being furthered by technology that we did not dream of at the time, and I'll give you an example. There's a company called Eloquia Networks, which sells probably one of the world's best, this is an advertisement, wire rate packet inspector. Up to multiple gigabits of data can come in, and they can analyze every bit of data that's flowing through that pipe, make decisions about it in real time, and decide whether to forward the packets or not, or for that matter, they sell it to the intelligence community for real-time analysis. So it's a technology that can be used in lots of different ways. Their current market, if you go to their website, is to sell to access providers and to gateways between companies. And their pitch, not surprisingly, is we can let you give fine-grained control over who can get which packets where. Okay. And it's very inexpensive. It costs a couple $100,000 to put one of those things on that can handle all the traffic for a city. So the question is, if it's really inexpensive and you can get some benefit out of it by blocking traffic and directing, as in the days of Stroger, when Stroger invented the first telephone switch, he did it because he was an undertaker. And he was an undertaker who, and the manual operators at the time one of the manual operators in his town was the sister of his competitor. And every time somebody needed an undertaker, she sent the calls to his competitor. Okay. And they had a deal, right? So the fundamental question is there a necessity, and this is where policymakers and not me get in the game, is there a necessity to put something in place that prevents that kind of very easy technological solution? You know, and it's very, we've known it's easy. Eloquia and other companies are actually making it easy and selling it.
Right.
And the application of that kind of technology, just as an example, to do what hotels do now, you know, I can't send email from a hotel, right? And the reason I can't send an email from a hotel is because the view of the ISP for the hotel is if they let email go through their pipe without looking at it, it might be spam. That's a perfectly reasonable thing. I might be a spammer. But my company requires me to send the email encrypted. And the hotel says, well, encrypted stuff is almost definitely spam. So they block it. So I can't send email from a hotel unless I use my cell phone. It's a complicated policy process. It's a broken one.
Yeah, Dave, I think
that's a really, you know, at the fundamental of the thing here is, can we go from a relatively competitive space to a space where some bottleneck along the way can acquire advantage?
I think that's an excellent segue into let's try to delve down a little more deeply into a few issues here, because I think the way to think about this, I think there's really two or three issues. There's the issue of blocking degradation, and then, if you will, giving a priority. So let's look at each one of these for a minute. Are there situations? Maybe Dave, you can address. Are there situations where you could envision affirmative blocking, where an ISP could say, now you might say, let me add one other thing. I think the other way to think about this is we need to differentiate between the practices and whether we think they're okay, and then what the remedies are. The remedies may be you don't need a remedy because openness and market choices would solve it, or you may say you need a more affirmative remedy. Let's leave those aside for a minute. Just talk about practices. Dave, do you think there are situations where, like, for example, port blocking, where you know that the port is a virus, a home for viruses, or just even spam blocking. And to me, that, some would argue, violates net neutrality,
right?
And yet you needed to manage a network.
I think experience sort of says that you need the ability to do some forms of blocking. Spam is a good example of that. You also need to exert some forms of quality of service. You know, if I'm getting a text message, even a large amount of files, I'm much less interested in the statistical behavior of the arrival of the information. If I'm doing voice over IP, I'm very interested that it not exceed a certain bound or it's unusable. And And so, in fact, there is a stress there because as a carrier, I want to guarantee, as a network supplier, forget about the access issue, I have to guarantee certain properties of that network if I'm going to satisfy my customers' demands. Now, I just go back historically, one of the goals of network design was to be able to install a reasonable quality of service mechanism, so things that are real-time demand quality of service could be implemented. It's been a hard act, but my memory serves me correctly. The assumption that was on most of the technologists' mind is, yeah, if we could do it, it probably is going to cost some in capacity, et cetera. Not much, but it will probably be a extra charge service, quote charge. It will be something you ask for. If you try to give quality of service to everybody, for everything, you don't get quality service out of it.
Well, let's try to put quality service aside just for a second and just go to blocking. And see, I'm curious whether there's agreement on the panel. David, do you think there's any situation affirmative blocking is okay?
So this comes down to a question. You might call it a question of agency. In that hotel situation or in any situation, I get lots of spam. I probably get more spam than most of you guys do. Maybe Dave gets more. You're right, but in the audience here. And a solution to spam would be worth a lot to me. The problem is spam is a tough thing to define. I get lots of stuff that other people might view as spam, and I view as valuable advertisements. I fine grain that. The thing I don't want is someone saying, I'm going to protect you from spam, and I have the technological base, the Eloquia thing, might be very useful for blocking spam, but I want it to implement my rules, not the rules that make, the funeral director richer, right? On the side. I don't want that to be used as an excuse.
Right, I think there's two issues. There's an issue of bad blocking, which we can all agree on. Blocking a site because you're a competitor. Right. I think everybody agrees that one's bad.
So let me just the point of the debate is that it's possible, and this is where we created the end-to-end argument in the original argument, is where does the decision of what to block get made, where does the policy decision get made, and where does it get implemented? So if we have an Eloquia filter, it's not unreasonable to add a very small feature to that, which basically says the filter that gets applied to my traffic is the filter I set as the ultimate recipient, right? That's called the end-to-end argument. It basically says put the control at the ends because those are the ultimate sources and sinks of stuff. So if you take that as a principle in your architecture, you can do almost anything. You can do blocking. You can do all kinds of things. The one thing you can't do is and this is a different category of affirmative blocking, is what's called non-discretionary control. That is, controls that are imposed by your boss, by your company, by your city, by your country, that say, I don't care. If you're going to block something, I'm going to block this because it's a national defense priority or because it's a theft of trade secrets or something like that. That's where a third party actually has an interest that is not necessarily the interest of the endpoint. But I think those are the two things, and I think you can implement them in a way that preserves that control, and that's where I think the real net neutrality is. If you implement it, you have to give the control to the endpoints, not to the middleman.
Couple concrete examples. Most ISPs, I would suspect all the ISPs that most of us subscribe to, block port 25. It is a haven for viruses and spam. And so just as a matter of architecture, almost every ISP does it, period. And most of us would regard ourselves as being better off. Many ISPs are now blocking a portion of ESPN. I don't know if you are addicted to the site the way I am, but they push video through there. And if you leave yourself on the front website, they will stream video onto your screen whether you're watching it or not. So if I leave myself on the ESPN site and walk away, they are pushing through lots of bandwidth, the most intensive stuff. And what happens nowadays is ISPs, after a certain point, will turn off the faucet because they're taking up stuff. They're taking up bandwidth and creating congestion on the network at a time where maybe no one is even watching it. Or maybe I just like watching the same thing cycling through over and over again. And so what's interesting is we have these different problems, and people are taking walk-in solutions to them. I agree with David Reed, that ideally this should happen at the edge. What's been the problem over the years is there are some functions which seem to be best implemented within the network. They're rare. But even David's initial work says they exist. The historical one is voicemail. The first voicemail services, when we turned switches from big mechanical things to baby computers, it was much easier to put the voicemail capability in the baby computer sitting in the switch. And in fact, if we said, well, you're creating an application and an intelligence in the middle of the network that shouldn't be there, they had to get a special waiver under the rules that blocked that at the time. And in fact, the delayed voicemail services, switch-oriented, provided by the switch by about a decade. And so it's interesting. I think that the end-to-end argument is a wonderful principle. I think it should prevail most of the time. The question is, as different people want different things from the network, will there be times where, and David's work even suggests this, there may be times where we do that, we want to do different things. The response is, I do think that there's standardization, there's a huge value to standardization, and in fact, it's ironic because the usual argument in that is that the desire for standardization gets us locked into technologies, not that it's going to create change, it creates too little change. It's called lock-in and tipping, it's the traditional argument. What's interesting to me is, there is the conventional policy answer from there's an optimal level of standardization. And that, in fact, sometimes it's one network that does everything, but if enough people want different things from the network, what you may find is the optimal level of standardization is broader than the one screen that provides everything. And that, looking for that optimality principle is the real policy challenge, because maybe it's one screen, maybe it's not. The only thing I'm worried about is us regulating our way to standardization level of one at a time, and we never see what the other world looks like because we have a regulatory barrier that won't let us get there.
I'm going to come to you, Christian.
Okay. Jim.
I want to try to get through two or three other issues here particularly around enhancement, QoS. I'm just going to assume for a minute that there is a situation where networks have to block. And we can agree that the ideal might be on the edge, but I'm going to agree with Christopher that maybe for now you have to do it. How do we avoid a situation, though, Tim, where I think this is a lot of the core of the net neutrality theory, particularly among kind of the content people. There'll be, even though you need to do that, if you allow it, you open up the slippery slope. And how would you allow good stuff and stop bad stuff? I mean, there clearly is bad blocking, and there's a risk of bad blocking.
Right.
What's the response to that?
You mean, what is the regulatory response, or what's the ideal network?
Well, I think the idea, to me, the ideal network is good blocking's okay and bad blocking's not. What's bad?
An evil detector.
Yeah, an evil detector. I mean, it seems self-dealing, free speech, those sorts of things. That's something that have absolutely nothing to do with network management,
but we can find
that. But I guess I'm thinking more of the regulatory or other policy ends. Doesn't have to be regulation.
Well, let me just say, we shouldn't, blocking should be highly suspect. I mean, it's maybe in extreme circumstances necessary, but we have to realize that every time you do it, it comes at a cost. Now, we say good blocking is good and bad blocking is bad. So does the Chinese government say that when they block off all the democracy sites, and they say, well, we've chosen all the blocking for everybody else. We figured out what are the bad sites, like Falun Gong and Taiwanese independence, and we block them off, and we figured out what the good sites are, so we've got the best blocking scheme going. And, the Internet in China suffers from that level of blocking. I was there in the summer, and it's a mess because they're making decisions at the center which are really bad decisions. Now, every time you trust a centralized entity to make the blocking decisions, you lose something, right? The power of the Internet, and David Reed said it powerfully, is it harnesses the American spirit of individualism, of everybody deciding for themselves what they want. And every time you delegate that power to the center, you lose something. The cable companies early on, for example, they were pretty sure no one would need these home networking things, and they'd probably, like ESPN, be a huge drain on the network. So their early agreements banned home networking, and some of them declared it a federal crime. And their idea was, they were making the centralized decision on behalf of everyone that home networking probably wasn't going to be that important. They turned out to be wrong, and thank goodness consumers violated their poses it anymore. So I'm saying that always comes at a cost. How do you decide what is good and what is bad? I think the thumb on the scale has to be in favor of presuming that all blocking comes at a cost and has to be justified. This is the kind of thing we see in other areas of law. Discrimination, we say in a lot of areas of law, like civil rights law, is usually wreaking an economic harm unless you have a strong justification for it. And so I think the legal way to think about this for the lawyers in the audience is our standard idea that, you know, in a lot of areas we believe that, you know, for example, discrimination on the basis of sex or race is bad unless there is a very strong loss to innovation and to the economy, and in some circumstances can be defended or justified, but needs to be done so.
So would everybody agree then that at least part of the answer to this is some sort of openness, disclosure, that you have to, companies yeah. have to disclose what they're doing?
Yeah, actually I should have said that. You know, I think the major issue, I think the one thing that everyone on this panel and everyone in this room should agree upon is that more information cannot be a bad thing. And the only people who do disagree with this seem to be the carriers, and I'm not sure why. You know, knowing what kind of bandwidth you get, know what sites are being blocked or not being blocked, is the beginning of knowing what is a good or bad. I mean, how can we even decide as a society what is a good or bad blocking when we don't know what's going on? I'll turn again to the Chinese government. It is impossible to figure out what's being blocked and not blocked in China at any time, because it always looks like, well, it could just be the network's down. It's, you know, we're even able to have a discussion in the first place as to what is good blocking and what is bad blocking. We may figure out eventually that, you know, like you said, port 25 or certain sites are, but if no one knows what's going on, there's no process to even understand what's being blocked. Huge mistakes can be made and can be made for decades without us realizing it.
Christopher?
You know, I balk a little bit at the China example, not because I want to defend it, because you can't. Can government censor? Yes. I mean, that's the lesson, and we have rules that we understand. Governments have powers in a way that private people don't, even networks. What's interesting to me is the home networking example that Tim says is a bad story, I actually think is a good story. What we had was a market response rejecting the policies imposed by these companies, and one company started to do it and they all collapsed. And so are there changes that we have that we need to work out? Yes. Do they take some time? Yes. That's just what technological change does. But in fact, I think that's a great example of how things worked out without intervention. Now, and antitrust law gives us an interesting framework. That's a haven for a lot of competition policy. And it creates a difference between per se rules and rule of reason. And it's very simple. It says, if something's always bad, ban it. If something's always good, mandate it. What do you do if you can tell stories where it's sometimes good and sometimes bad? Okay? And the answer is, you do those case by case. But the question is, where do you put your thumb? Do you say you can't do it unless you show case by case it's good, or you can do it unless you show case by case it's bad? And it's a question of who got the burden of proof. And the traditional answer from antitrust law is economic change and technological change needs breathing room to experiment. So if you have an ambiguous practice, you're not sure if it's going to be good or bad, they say, let them try, and if it turns out it's bad, we'll step on it. In other words, you have to give the default to let people experiment in order to give technology change and economic change room to breathe. And that's the answer the Supreme Court's come to. I think it's a pretty useful way for us to think it here. I would agree that there are circumstances in which you can have bad stories come out, but I think that we can address those case by case, but we shouldn't say you can't do it until you show to us how great it's going to be. When we see from, you know, AOL Time Warner was supposed to be the end of the history, it just turned out to be a chance for them to lose an awful lot of money. You know, our ability to anticipate what these things are going to be is very limited. And so I'd be more inclined to let the standard business and antitrust standards to let people try. And if it turns out to be bad, we can regulate it.
David, I want to move on, because yeah. we've only got a few more minutes. I want to deal with this issue of prioritization. But whether we ban it or not, for a consensus, it seems to me we all agree that disclosure and information is a key part of this, no matter what regime would be on top of it, yeah. if any. I think it's important to deal with is this issue of prioritization or QoS. So let's just assume for a minute that prioritization doesn't mean affirmative degradation. There's no blocking involved. We're simply saying prioritization. Dave, you've written about prioritization. You want to say from a network perspective why you think that might be a valuable?
I think in many applications you have to deal with the fact that they're very sensitive to timing, to variance of the data coming in. You're not going to watch a video program that sits there, sometimes working, sometimes not, or VoIP that half the time doesn't work. So you need some quality there. Now, the question is, it can be engineered into the system by overcapacity of the system, and that costs money in general. Even though some people seem to claim that, well, there's an infinite amount of bandwidth and it doesn't cost you anything, in practice, every case I've seen, it costs me money to provide that, and I have to over-engineer the system. And the question that there is, I can just sort of charge everybody for it, or I can decide that if you want to receive that type of information, you should buy a quality channel as opposed to a non-quality channel. We do that now. I can get, 760 kilobits from my friendly supplier at one price, or I can get 6 megabits at a higher price. What I can't get out of them right now is any knowledge of how good that high-speed connection is. And that goes back to this, give me the information and let me as a user, I hate the word consumer, make that judgment call.
Yeah, let's stay on this issue of prioritization. Sure. Dave says that there's a need for it with VoIP or video latency. Do you agree, David?
And well, I think, you know, I'm going to sort of reiterate the fact that it comes down to how you implement that approach, because it's very clear that voice, real-time voice or interactive gaming, for that matter, for a new application that's very latency sensitive, needs a different kind of service for its packets than other things. And if I purchase from, you know, my local access provider, which again, as I say, the threat is now at the access provider level, a line that all of their physical plant is capable of delivering that quality of service to me, and they decide I'm going to provide that quality of service to you if it comes from a vendor I've got to deal with, that's quite different than saying I'm going to provide that quality of service to you from the other thing, for anything that has those characteristics. So if I can access any, you know, high-speed first-person shooter game with thousands of other people on the planet through that line, which is the only asset that, you know, say AT&T or Verizon owns, that's fine. But if they make a deal upstream that says, well, we're going to kind of skew our traffic a little bit, and we'll argue, as they often do, that, you know, they only got that deal for, you know, for games from Blizzard Entertainment or something like that, then you start to suspect. And what you see over and over again, I saw it when I was on the FCC TAC, the cable companies say, oh, we're going to build a private network for voice. That sounds fine. It's great to have a private network for voice because, you know, among the cable companies, because that allows you to prioritize voice over a different path. What's not so great is when you say, oh, and by the way, it's only for our phone services. So you're basically tying the service to this other thing. And what do they mean by our phone services? Not even things that are the same company. It's whoever they can sign a contract with. And that, you know, the question of how you implement prioritization can be done purely technically, and we know how to do it. We can make, you know, when packets are waiting in a queue, which is the primary delay, you can move packets to the front of the queue. But the little marker that says on it, if it says, I need to be at the front of the queue, I paid 50 cents more, whatever it is, can be interpreted one way, or it can be because I have a contract with so-and-so. Yeah. And that's a big difference.
Get two pieces, and then we'll open it up for questions. One is, would everybody on the panel agree that self-dealing should not be allowed, that you can't prioritize your own service with and not give that to someone else?
Well, it's not just self-dealing. It's selling out to one high.
No, I'm not. That's a contentious point. Agreement point that self-dealing only doing your own VoIP and not giving VoIP competitors prioritization. I think would everyone agree that's not valid?
On the internet, I mean, if people want to build completely separate private networks, sure. I've always said that's fine.
On the open internet.
Yeah. My understanding of cable providers is that it's not on the open internet.
You know, this may not be a incredibly popular position, but I want to push back on a little bit, I guess, just as a possibility. I'm not convinced, but, you know, I keep thinking about the breakup of AT&T, and the AT&T was designed to create competition in long distance. We now have these things. We don't have competition in long distance anymore in terms of the same way. What we have, you don't get to choose your long distance provider when you get your cell phone. So instead, they choose it, and you get one. And in that sense, but these things are very competitive. You know, this is the funny thing, is that what you may see is a strategic partnership between the guy who's providing me connection to my cell phone tower and a one-to-one correspondence with a particular long distance, because right now it's not clear long distance is a separate service. It's a throw-in that we now get for free. Mm-hmm. And it is possible that we may see business models where someone says, yes, if you buy this, you're getting this VoIP service because I want the volume or I want something else. And if we have enough last mile choices, I don't have any problem with that. But it's not clear to me. The big problem is whether we have enough last mile choices to make that good.
And with when the cell phone industry had two players per market, you had very, very little competition. The thing that made it fly was there were five, six, I guess the record is now seven, suppliers. So, in fact, it's a fixed market and a lot of competition.
Right. Well, right now there's four, but mostly. But the sellers would
play games.
You know, I think I want to talk about the prioritization. I think I want to add a legal...
Just 1 minute, because I want to open it up for questions. So
okay.
Go ahead.
I want to echo David Reed's comments and say the model for this, of what he's talking about, is the AT&T merger agreement. And if you look carefully at the AT&T merger agreement, it has an approach to prioritization, which I think is worth looking at. Namely, it says that if carriers want to, AT&T obviously wants to, it can upgrade its network as much as it likes to support better video delivery, better whatever it wants to deliver at different rates. The only thing it is allowed to discriminate, in other words, on the basis of what it's carrying, what kind of thing. It just can't discriminate as to who it's carrying it from. There's the distinction. You know, you can pick up video packets, speed them up. If you configure something's voice, you can speed that up. What you can't do is choose one competitor over another competitor where you have, you know, market dominance or a duopoly and make them the preferred provider. So that's the AT&T merger agreement's approach, and I think it's worth looking at. That's the minute, I hope.
Yeah, thank you. It is worth looking at. We could do this for six or seven or eight more days, I think, because I'm serious, because it is very complex, and CDT and ITIF have been sort of doing this as a little exercise. Many of you have been involved in that, and there's all sorts of nuances here and very important nuances and exceptions, which we're not going to get into. So I'd like to – we've got about 12 minutes left. I'm going to ask you, when you ask your question, make it – don't make a speech. Ask a question. Sir, right here.
Yes, I'm Scott Cleland, chairman of netcompetency.org, but I'm representing the broadband company. Very simple one-sentence question. Is there more risk from maintaining the status quo or in passing a new net neutrality law like Jordan Stone?
More risk. I mean, I think there's less risk in passing the law. I mean, the law is designed, the law, I mean, like Dorgan Snow, is pretty minimal. It's designed just to say, you know, it's designed to maintain the status quo, basically. I mean, I think that's the answer. It's designed to prevent the worst forms of blocking and discrimination, and it leaves a lot of stuff open to do whatever the hell you want. So I don't think it's a risk.
I think it's the wrong question, oddly enough, which is, it's not, is this better or is that better? The question is the risk of change so dangerous? What will happen? If someone makes a change and the market rejects it, they get hammered down, they change back. So the question is not, is the danger of letting them experiment in that way so dangerous that we can't even let them do that? And a one-size-fits-all internet grew up based around a 1970s set of protocols when it was primarily for academics to exchange emails and files. A lot more users using it in a lot more different way. The way people want from the net changes is much more diverse. And we should expect the networks to diversify to try to meet those challenges. And if one player wants to experiment in a different direction, the question is not, am I convinced that their experiment is better? The question is what they're trying to do so dangerous to the whole network that we can't permit them to experiment and wait and see if the market rejects it? Because we might lose it that it was better. And they got the change model where originally the internet was an overlay running on a voice network. Voice is now an application running on the internet, and what is the network has changed. Akamai may be the change model for what is the network. We don't know. What I'm worried about is a vision of what it's supposed to look like may stop that from happening.
David?
Yeah, I was almost ready to agree with Christopher, but you went too far.
Sorry.
I think the, you know, one of the key things about the design of the internet originally was the goal to be able to deal with unanticipated and massive change, and I think we did a pretty good job of doing that by keeping it very simple and focusing on a couple, th- three or four core principles. And I think what was intended by the net neutrality folks, and I can't comment on Dorgan Snow and its legislative history, was a core principle that really focuses in the same space. That is, that it's a core principle that traffic should not be discriminated against based on source or based on the type of content or based on the type of application it's being based on by those who just provide transport for the bids. And I'm not quite sure how you craft that in language, but that doesn't lead to the kind of, you know, federal bureaucracy that then starts looking at all the different entities, I don't think. Just like the IETF is a relatively small standards organization. Right. What would be dangerous, and I really do worry about, is piling an enormous set of, you know, wish lists of every political actor onto a bill that tries to deal with every, you know, bloody shirt that's being waved by some, you know, person in there, because I do think innovation is crucially about dealing with the unanticipated part. And I think if you can keep the core principle of when you have access to the internet, at least, maybe not to, you know, NBC's, you know, the WB is a network too, but it only has its programs and it's overlaid on things. But when you have access to the internet, you ought to be able to send packets to anybody who wants to send packets to you, who can be anywhere in the world, and we should preserve that quality, which is what
Dave, really quickly.
Yeah, I just commented that the FCC's four principles essentially provide a framework for thinking about what's good and bad. Adding a law to that says the FCC has to do it, from my experience, is it going to make them do it or make them not do it? And the mischief that can be made by passing laws in this Congress is sort of frightening. I mean, once you start passing laws in this game, I get real scared, because if you can pass a law that says, quote, this is good, maybe you can pass a law that says this is not good. Maybe adult entertainment on the internet shouldn't be allowed. And once you get your hands in that, the Congress tends to go ape.
Yes, sir. Do you want to identify yourself, please?
You should block everything. John Gilmore's.
The question was, if all traffic is encrypted, how does this play out?
You block all encrypted traffic. I mean, it's a thing that I'm sure many countries would love to do. John Gilmore, I think, put it nicely when he says that the network tends to route around censorship. Well, yeah, it's real tricky to tell an encrypted, last time I looked at least, it's trivially from a picture. And it's real tricky to keep people from embedding stuff in pictures.
I actually have a reaction to that. I work with lots of people, and even on some days I wake up and think that would be the answer, that encryption technology is very inexpensive, and that if everybody transmitted their traffic encrypted, we'd have a neutral network. I think there are two policy, source and destination, but there, you can even do that by routing things through, you know, through cutouts in the middle, essentially. But I think there's two arguments that mitigate against that. One is that it actually is useful to declare to the network the quality of service you want. So you actually do have to reveal stuff. If you're going to send something that needs a rapid delivery, and you're also going to send stuff that needs slow delivery, you want to disclose that. That's a mutual good for the network and you. It does, however, help with the avoiding prioritization on issues that you don't want that the network doesn't need to know about. So that may be a solution. The other side of it is related to why we structure the patent law the way we do. And I've only thought about this, but the patent law is designed to encourage disclosure and encourage sharing. And in return for that, it gives some limited rights to people. And I think there is an argument for having traffic be disclosed in the network, sources and destinations, because it's actually useful for engineering the network itself, for predicting the network. And so you know, I think maybe the market does go to all encrypted if this becomes a tussle that the end users fight to win, and it very well might become all encrypted because it's not clear, you know, that you could do otherwise unless the government passes a law that says you can't send encrypted traffic.
Other questions?
That's, you know.
Yes, sir.
If I don't, of course.
No, I don't agree with it. I don't think it does. Well,
you want to go ahead?
No, go on. Go on.
Yeah.
I want to hear that.
I mean, I think. I think the point of the bill is it assumes that you might want to prioritize or experiment because you want to try and make your connection most valuable possible, right? To the users. I mean, that's an important principle here, and I think that the idea of Dargan Snow is to leave room for carriers to experiment with trying to improve their network. What the Dargan Snow is trying to block, and also the AT&T merger agreement, if you look at it, is the problem of picking and choosing among different sources or different competitors, which, given the market conditions, is likely to create a distortion in the applications market. So I think it's a balance between those two issues. As for the, I wanted to just say one thing about the encryption. You know, I think it points to an important point. I mean, everyone talking about going to encryption or what users will do. No, I think that, you know, we talk about these laws, and I think they're important, but I also agree, this is one area I agree with Chris, is that the consumer response has been very important here, and it shows, again, the importance of disclosure. I mean, there's one law people should agree upon. It's, you know, for sure, it's more disclosure, because then this, you know, the market can only function when people know what's being blocked, what's going on, what kind of prioritization steps are being taken, so if they don't like it, they can get mad and do something about it. And I think people did get mad. I mean, you look at the cable story we were talking about. People got mad and were thinking, Michael Powell kind of yelled and gave a speech saying this is where the four freedoms came from, saying, you know, you can't be doing this kind of stuff and quit it. And eventually went to, you know, finding an Arbach. And so, you know, there is some interplay there, but none of that can happen without enough disclosure. So I think that's one of the things.
David, David had his hand up.
I'm
over to you.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize one thing. All the experiments in the past I've seen where you provide quality of service ranking but you don't charge for it tend to make everybody say, I want it. The old computer scheduling game. You know, if it didn't cost me anything, high priority, man. I think you have to put a cost function in there.
I mean, the metaphor is a first-class mail versus express mail, right? We used to have one service, they wanted to provide something faster, and if everything could go there one day, everyone does that. Now, the funny thing, what happens if we make it one class of service? My guess is they'll split the difference. It'll get there somewhat faster than first class mail and charge a little more. Or maybe they charge it a first class mail. If you have to get it there overnight, there's no amount of money you can pay for getting it there. Or everything's express mail, and the guy who's previously paying 37 cents and doesn't care if his bill gets it in 3 days doesn't get service. And you get somewhere in the middle, and you get some shut out on both sides. The logical thing to do is, if you absolutely have to get it there, pay for it. You know, and I'll pay. There's times I'll pay. You know, we now pay extra to get it there at 6 o'clock in the morning. So the question is, you know, if you make it all one class of service, you end up with a really weird situation. Now, the one last comment I'll make is, I was at the speech when Michael Powell articulated the four freedoms, and in fact, you can read it. It's published. It's very clear that it wasn't a regulatory mandate. He was saying, this is good practices, which I urge you to take, and very clearly has made it clear in that speech and in subsequent statements that he thinks regulating would be a mistake.
Other questions? We'll go back there and then here if we have time.
Yeah, can you
you identify yourself? Thank you. David, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. You just have to ask yourself, where does that value get added? And the answer gets, I can certainly ask an internet provider that I get to route all of my traffic through a party that will add information, and I'd even, if they were adding information, be happy to pay them, right? So that's what you might call an end-based or edge-based solution. Even if it doesn't happen at my edge decides to route it back through that. And that's quite different from some vendor deciding that they're going to build that into the network and provide it to me without my asking for it, and in fact deciding that they ought to have access to everybody's packets just because I want that service, right? And that's, it seems to me quite simple. It's really saying that that's not in the domain of net neutrality, although there are those who, try to lump into the net neutrality debate things like whether Google charges for advertising. Google may provide its service over the internet, but Google is not the internet, contrary to...
All right, let's do one more question, and then we will close. Yes, sir, please identify yourself.
Gary Owen, Marlin Communications. Your opening comment was about competition. In rare markets like San Francisco, we've got legacy wire carriers that have not got AT&T, and why not carriers like Google and potentially others, maybe five altogether? Will any of you speculate as to this, what that kind of competitive market would be if some are net neutral and others are
The main point I've been trying to make is that would be great. Yeah. This is how specialty stores survive in a Walmart world, is they change what they're offering to match what a subgroup of the total population really wants, and even if they're at a cost disadvantage against the big Walmart player, they can survive that way. And I could see, especially if you have five players and you have a neutral network as a consumer option, this is only a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's a really good economic... There's a good economic question as to whether actually more than one broadband provider, and I don't have a view on this, really is going to survive in the long run. There's still something called the economics of natural monopoly, and it's hard to see why, how, if, for example, Verizon has a great Fios base in this area, that it's not clear that more than the duopoly will survive. I don't think government should take a guess on that. Everyone in this room would think it would be great if there were five providers. But one of the things we say is, okay, it's going to happen any day. It's around the corner. Power over cable line, 10 competitors. But you talk to most Americans, it's a duopoly, right? And if you keep saying, any day now this is all going to happen, sometimes you have to face the facts that maybe this really is, like local phone service, something that is fairly resistant to being a 10-player market. It just doesn't seem to be happening. And I think sometimes, the FCC study, I don't know how they came up with these numbers, but suggests in these rural towns there's 10 different providers, and you hear these facts recited. But you talk to people, and everyone, I think, over 90% of the people I've ever talked to, either cable or DSL or fax, that whether we like it or not, this last mile carriage may in fact be a natural monopoly, and we have to deal with that the way it is.
I hope, but you're not even going to get to comment on that, Dave, because I'm going to stop us, because Jerry's telling me if I don't, I'm going to be in big trouble. So, first of all, I want to thank this panel. This is a great panel. I could not imagine a better panel on this issue. So.